You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
With it being Pride this week, it's important not only to celebrate how far we've come in support of the marginalized LGBTQIA+ community, but it's also important in acknowledging where we need to go and actually taking time to listen to these communities. So last year in June of 2018, the World Health Organization removed the classification of mental illness from being transgender. And this felt like a huge step for many within the community as a step to alleviate stigma many transgender people experience on a daily basis. Senior lecturer of Waikato University, Jamie Veal, tells us how the history of classifying being transgender as a mental illness has impacted and continues to impact care within New Zealand's healthcare system for those who are transgender.
I guess I'm not sure to what extent people might know the history of gender-affirming healthcare, but there's definitely a history of the model of seeing being transgender as a mental illness. And back in the older days, I guess, there was you really had to go through the diagnosis, the mental health disorder diagnosis for being transgender, and so that was the assessment. Thankfully, we've moved on from those days, but there are still some things related to that. When I talked about, for example, the real life test, which is still happening in a few places where there is still that the mental health professional does really have that assessment and tell you whether you're trans or not. Thankfully, in some parts of the country, we're seeing it more and more that the acknowledgement that we're actually the experts of our own lives, and it's not really up to a mental health provider to tell us whether we're trans or not. What is their role is to make sure that we're fully informed to be able to make the best decisions for ourselves around the risks and benefits of any gender-affirming care. And so there's been some new guidelines for gender-affirming healthcare, which I've been part of authoring with a number of doctors and educators and nurses and endocrinologists from around the country, which I think has been helpful to give providers some more confidence and knowledge and expertise around that. And we're also been working to build networks amongst people who are working professionally for transgender health in this country. So we've got a Aotearoa Trans Health Symposium coming up in the University of Waikato in May, and we're looking at other ways to build networks for people working in this area so that we can all be well educated and work through international best practice.
Then the communications coordinator for Rainbow Youth, Tony Dutter, took some time out of a busy Pride Week to tell me more about how the healthcare system in New Zealand can be difficult for transgender people to navigate.
It's really hard to sum up. It's not straightforward at all, and it usually relies on the services available depending on where you live. But it usually relies on seeing your GP and indicating to them that you're questioning your gender identity or you identify as trans and that you would like to proceed with surgically or medically transitioning. In an ideal world, they'd then refer you to your local DHB and their endocrinology and psychological services. And also, GPs can, in theory, prescribe blockers to somebody who is prepubescent or so hasn't gone through puberty yet before they access DHB services. There are some, at Rainbow Youth, we don't hear of many GPs who will prescribe blockers, and they don't really specify a standard reason across them. Often people say it's dangerous or they can't, they just straight up lie. But it's really worth noting that blockers have been actually used in the market. They've been in the market for 30 years, and they've been used in all sorts of hormonal treatments. So whether that's women who, with different hormonal levels, to balance those out. And it's commonly thought that blockers are damaging, but actually 30 years of use proves that they're not. So yeah, again, healthcare varies from DHB to DHB. Auckland is the most readily accessible one. We have some centralised services that provide all of your healthcare needs as a trans person. But other than that, if you're outside of Auckland, you're sort of at the whim of a DHB system that's sort of not set up to support trans people. You rely on word of mouth, and often you have to actually educate your healthcare professionals.
Mm. And so the other thing on from that, you're saying Auckland is basically the most trans-friendly healthcare system. Do we find discrimination within Auckland and outside of Auckland as well?
Yeah, so over 80% of Rainbow Youth's one-on-one support cases are actually helping people navigate the trans healthcare system inside Auckland, but also regionally as well. And it's hard to tell the exact types of discrimination that's coming out in healthcare. There's no up-to-date research about that. But we do hear anecdotally stories from young people who've tried to talk to their GP about being trans and been told that hormones are only for bodybuilding. We've had, for trans men especially, there's a huge pressure and a focus on fertility. So if they take hormones, that they won't be able to have children, and that they should take more time to make this decision. But the time that doctors, GPs say, or endocrinologists say that these people have to sort of wait to make the decision is arbitrary. It depends on the doctor. There's no standardized waiting time. So it just shows that these things are more value-based than an actual informed medical practice. Doctors will tell young people that their legal name and a sex assigned at birth is like legally required that they use it on all communication to the patient, whether that's letters sent to them or just people being referred to by the pronouns they were assigned at birth and named assigned at birth while they're in the doctor's office or the hospital, which is just not true. You know, we have our national health number, which is unique to all of us, that can then be sufficient to track a patient and should contain the sex assigned at birth in our file, but we can be referred to by our preferred name and pronouns like any other organisation. So, yeah, there are so many colloquial and anecdotal incidents of discrimination, and it's really important that we acknowledge that lack of widespread studies about this doesn't actually mean it's not happening.
Mm. I also wanted to ask about the process.
Yes.
I'm wondering if it is a largely bureaucratic process.
Yes, definitely. So the latest sort of statistics we have, they're quite outdated. They're from 2012, but they still paint quite a picture. So young people, trans young people reported 39% were unable to see a health professional when needed in the past 12 months, so they're waiting longer than 12 months, compared to 18% of their cisgender peers. So there is a discrepancy in the bureaucracy of trans healthcare as opposed to sort of regular healthcare, especially outside of the city. So people sometimes have to travel over an hour each way to access appropriate services, and even then they still face those barriers of having to educate the professionals they're working with. And as well as this, people often resort to taking out personal loans because the process in going privately or going overseas, because the process of accessing the public healthcare system around trans healthcare requires years often of back and forth between different areas of, you know, mental health and endocrinology and surgery and all that kind of stuff, and it just wears down trans people's mental health and resilience.
Mm. And I'm also curious with that, in terms of someone who doesn't present neurotypically, so someone who could be autistic.
Yes.
Often there's a psychological assessment that comes into play. So how does someone who doesn't present neurotypically navigate that?
With considerable difficulty. So we do work with a lot of neurodiverse trans people, And what they find is because of the idiosyncratic way that a lot of people on the autism spectrum have of communicating, in the current state of our trans healthcare, it means that it can cause further delays and more questioning about their capacity to sort of be self-aware and sure of their decisions. But it's important to acknowledge that every person is the expert of their own experience, and regardless of how somebody communicates those things, if they are communicating all of the necessary, I guess, criteria, which is a problematic thing in itself, but that a doctor must, you know, they should be, you know, carry on the process regardless of their neurodiversity.
Mm. Also, just touching on what exactly defines transgender healthcare, I find this really interesting because from a cisgender person and a cisgender person who doesn't interact with the trans community very much, I feel like there is a bit of a pushback from the public against what defines it. So can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. So it's broad. Every journey for a trans person is different. So some people just won't want to have surgery or medically transition or just socially transition. But the basic tenets of sort of medical transition, I guess, would be, you know, you have breast augmentation or top surgery, depending on whether you're a trans guy or a trans woman. You can have laser hair removal. You can do more cosmetic things like liposuction and lip fillers to sort of feminize or masculinize the appearance of your body. There's things like shaving Adam's apples, vocal training, hysterectomies and bottom surgery for both trans and women and trans men. But yeah, it's quite broad.
Mm. And why are those things important?
Why aren't they or why are they?
Sorry. Why are they?
Oh, are they? Yeah, I mean, they're important depending on the person, and I think a lot of it has to do with an individual's own relationship with their body, and it's really hard to quantify that in a broad term. However, it's really important to also consider the fact that for somebody who doesn't present within the norms of society, whether that's you know, visually, somebody walking down the street or whatever it is, they're open to way higher levels of harassment, bullying, violence, discrimination than people who are more traditionally fitting into those gender norms, which is called transphobia. And so, you know, often being able to fit in or pass as a trans person makes their life so much easier and sort of keeps them safer.
Mm. And of course, one of the big conversation points around this and an ethical dilemma is you have the Hippocratic Oath, where there's the perception that hormones can do harm to a person in terms of liver, or there's also the parallel with that, bodily autonomy, people being able to decide for themselves what they do with their own body. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think Rainbow Youth, we sort of look at the Hippocratic Oath as being quite a Western perception. So it really reflects a mindset where health is only about your physical being. But we must, especially in the context of New Zealand, look at Māori health models, which emphasise mental and spiritual health as being equally important as physical health. So when you deprive a gender diverse person of the healthcare that they've determined is right for them, you can actually harm their emotional well-being, which is doing harm. But another thing that's really important to consider is the fact that we emphasize informed consent in our medical decisions. So, for example, people are prescribed things all the time that have side effects. So the pill and antidepressants are two, like, real common ones. And it's the doctor's job to inform us of the side effects and leave us with the decision to take that medication or not. And I think hormones and blockers and any kind of medical care related to trans people should be treated exactly the same way. A trans person deserves to know all the information and make an informed choice about their body.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.